Okay, so I'm starting the second part now of topic 9 on we didn't quite get to the end of Metzinger or the discussion of Heidegger's picture thing at the end of the last lecture, but the discussion of Heidegger's picture thing, I would like to leave you to review yourself. But essentially, we have covered what Heidegger is saying about the idea that you can understand perception as if what you're perceiving is a picture of the world. And Heidegger doesn't really argue against it. He just says it just goes against the phenomenology. And he's almost like, full stop. It goes against the phenomenology, therefore it's wrong. Because the phenomenology is, I'm not looking at a picture when I perceive the world. And when I do look at a picture, and he's got his example of a postcard of the bridge that's local to him, he looks into it phenomenologically and says, when you look at a picture, it's an entirely different phenomenological event to immediate perception. And without there being something like direct perception of the world, we would have no notion of something being a picture. We wouldn't be able to make the distinction. Again, Metzinger's world is like a world where everything is a picture. We only just, and he's saying only we just don't realise it. So I'll leave you with just Heidegger's. He did sort of respond to Metzinger, but not explicitly or in an obvious way. But his account of the picture thing is a good phenomenological description of what it is to see something. It's all about intentionality again. You can see a picture in two ways. You can see, if it's a painting, you can see the paint and the way the colours have been laid on, and you could admire it as the object that it is and the skill that's gone into it and the materials that make the picture up. Or you can look through the materials and see what the picture depicts, and it's a shift of intentionality, a shift of meaning. And Heidegger is, in a sense, saying, and it's not like that with our immediate perception, because the senses, the colours, the sounds, they're not material things. They're the ultimate ground out of which all experience is constituted. They're the obvious ground. Yeah, they're non-pictorial. They don't exist. They present what exists. Whereas a picture actually uses stuff within the presentation, paint or ink, to depict something. And you can see it's a picture because there's some other medium is being used to depict what the picture depicts. But there's a final, ultimate ground out of which you can get no further back, and that's the pure qualities of the senses that are obviously not... it's not a picture, because colour isn't made of anything. I mean, Metzinger even recognises that. Colour's the ultimate out of which... You know, combined with the spatio-temporal dimensionality of consciousness, that's how anything can be anything for us. And remembering that Metzinger has this Platonism that says, no, behind that, there's the really real. And I think we'll just bounce from that into this final reading, which come on, aptly named The End of Philosophy. So that tells you for sure there isn't going to be another reading next week. So I know that I think we're going to maybe keep this. I'm not sure. If we get through this in the next hour or so, in the unlikely event, I may think of something new for next week. But I think we might spend the remainder of this lecture and next week looking at the later Heidegger. I'm not sure. This may have been the 1950s. It's certainly later Heidegger, and I thought it was a nice way to wrap things up with his kind of final view. He wouldn't call it consciousness. He calls it the clearing. But I think we need to, if we get into the clearing, you could say we're certainly still looking at what consciousness is. But he starts by saying, interestingly, that philosophy is at an end, or at least maybe the way I put it is the kind of philosophy that originated with Plato in Western European civilization has come to a kind of an end with us in our time.
It goes into the 1960s
as well. Is there a date on that?
Well, it says the basic writings from Being and Time, 1927, and To the Task of Thinking, 1964.
Mm. 64. So it
that's
is
quite significant.
Yeah.
The 60s,
but different to the 50s. Yes. So it's in my lifetime. We've actually entered into my lifetime. Mm.
Yeah, I didn't know that he was active in the 1960s.
Yeah.
I mean, when I saw 1964, I was like, wow, 1960.
Yeah.
But maybe he was very old.
No, I think he died in the 70s, didn't he?
76.
Yeah.
He died in 1976.
Yeah.
Brilliant modern scientist.
Yes, but he didn't publish much in the 60s.
What's going on?
But he did give a...
Yeah, he didn't turn into a hippie.
So we're let's go back to the beginning here, because this is a kind of a grand statement of Heidegger's later vision of things. It wraps an awful lot up, and if we can wrap up what Heidegger's saying here, we'll kind of wrap up the philosophy of consciousness, parts one and two. So philosophy is metaphysics. What is metaphysics? Metaphysics is an attempt to think beings as a whole. I think we may have looked at this when we looked at what is philosophy ages and ages ago. It's an attempt to grasp the whole. It's like the sciences, if you like, different areas of sciences are explicitly trying to grasp a part of the whole, except physics that thought it was trying to grasp the whole as well. There's a tendency for each science to get a bit that way inclined, you know, to think that it's going to grasp the whole. But philosophy explicitly is attempting to think the whole, to come to an understanding of all that is. Particularly for the Greeks, it was a new impulse on Earth to think beyond the mythical. You know, because traditionally a culture is given a kind of a mythical account of its origins and the origins of man and the origins of the universe. And philosophy was an attempt to, in some sense, to gain a rational, factual understanding of what it is, the whole, that doesn't rely on a mythical story from the psyche, if you like, that has some kind of valid grounds. Do you get a sense that, you know, the Garden of Eden, in a certain sense, or the Book of Genesis, they provide a certain kind of mythical story that doesn't, in a certain sense, it doesn't even intend to say this is exactly what happened. It's a kind of a story from the psyche. It's like the psyche knows something about where it came from that's symbolic, not factual. But philosophy doesn't want to is concerned with the whole, which means it's also concerned with understanding mythology. You know, it wants to, in some sense, set itself above everything, and say ultimately. When you want to say ultimately, then you're dealing with metaphysics. And for Heidegger, philosophy essentially is metaphysics. Although for many philosophers, they would say, no, I'm working philosophy of biology, and it's still philosophy. But ultimately, if you're a philosopher, you have to provide the final grounds for what it is you're doing. And particularly, he wants to emphasise that the sort of Platonic heritage is that it's a representational thinking, it's a reflective, rational attempt to, if you like, we've got our immediate experience of being, now we're going to reflect on that and make it explicit to ourselves. We're going to represent it to ourselves, and we're going to represent it, and we're going to give the grounds. We want to uncover the grounds of what is. And in some sense, I mean, the early Greek philosophers attempted to do that by saying it's all water. Everything comes from water. Water is the ground out of which everything comes. Or everything is change, everything is flux. That was Heraclitus. Giving some kind of ultimate principle out of which, or ground, out of which everything else can be understood and explained and finds its place. And in a way, we're looking in our time at this idea of matter being the ground upon which we're going to understand everything. And what a lot of this course has been about is we're still really in a culture that's looking for grounds, and the grounds that this culture has is that everything is ultimately explainable or explicable in terms of material stuff. And our problem, the gaping absence is our inability to account for consciousness. So we accept that there is a presencing, we have our experience, and in a sense, philosophy is an attempt to give grounds or a basis upon which we can understand and give an account of all that it is, of all that is presented to us in experience. So what we say about the end of philosophy means the completion of metaphysics, which means that what Heidegger in a sense is saying is that project, that attempt, has kind of come to an end. It's run its course. And he's particularly picks on Nietzsche and Karl Marx as a kind of a reversal of Platonism, which Platonism was an attempt to say that you can explain the shadows on the cave, our sensory experience, in terms of these eternal ideas, that there's a higher and a lower. We were talking about this at the beginning of the lecture. Nietzsche's reversal of Platonism, which is also a reversal of Schopenhauer's view. Schopenhauer gave an account of experience that says that, from Kant, that there's the appearance of experience, but behind that, there's the thing itself. There's the thing in itself. And the thing in itself, whatever it is, for Kant and for Schopenhauer, it may have been some kind of idealist view of... I mean, for Schopenhauer, it wasn't God. Maybe for Kant, it was God. That there was a greater reality that accounts for the experience that we have. Nietzsche's reversal of that was saying, no, there isn't a greater reality behind this sensory experience. We have to reject that. We have to, you know. And I'm not going to give you a lecture on Nietzsche, because I'm getting the feeling that you're already studying Nietzsche, aren't you? some of you.
Theory.
In theory. Because I'm not a Nietzsche scholar in that sense. So my understanding of him is quite limited. But I know that he wanted to destroy Christianity, and he saw Christianity as a kind of a Platonism, and he wanted to replace that with the death of God, the death of the idea that there's some realm of eternal ideas, that all of that is a kind of a falsity that's been foisted on us, that's kind of denying our own essential potential to just live this life. This, and he's the beginning he's part of a kind of an existentialist move that's dispensing with all of this metaphysical stuff, and saying that almost enthroning man with a capital M as the power on earth, the power in the universe. So there isn't anything. There's no eternal godlike realm that's, in some sense, making sure everything's going to be okay. It's up to us. And then Nietzsche becomes all enamoured with the idea that of our needing to be superhuman. Yeah, we have to be superhuman because there is no God to take care of it for us. But this is, for Heidegger, he sees this is the kind of the end of a certain form of philosophy. It's got completely inverted now, and this search for some ultimate or transcendent grounds upon which everything can be explained is reversed. And although I don't quote him there, he's saying that something like all the positions that you could inhabit have already been tried out. It's all already been done. It's not Hegel, Karl Marx, and Nietzsche. They basically completed the arc of everything you could try out, existentialism is a sort of an extension of, but nothing, a derivative extension of Nietzsche's thinking. Nothing new is going to come out of it now. It's all been done. It's come to an end. And rightly so, as well. This is what he's saying too. Because he's talking about the dissolution of philosophy is being replaced by the development of the sciences that are the children of philosophy.
But Karl Marx, if you think about Karl Marx was a dialectical materialist, wasn't he?
Yes.
So is he saying that's a good thing, or...?
No, he's saying that Marx got rid of God as well. Got rid of the idea that there's some higher...
Yeah,
higher.
You're saying that Hegel's saying, and rightly so. So you suggested
Can you quote me back to myself? I forgot exactly what I said.
Heidegger. Then. You said Heidegger... You said, Heidegger suggests that Nietzsche and Marx have reversed metaphysics, and he thought rightly so.
No, and that's the end of metaphysics.
But
and I'm agreeing with Heidegger in a way that all avenues have been explored. Although Heidegger himself was a bit ambivalent about Nietzsche, he changed his mind about Nietzsche, I think. He wrote a lot about Nietzsche during the war, and saw a lot more in him, and I think he's come to a different opinion now, this part of what he's writing. But if I was saying rightly so, I was saying rightly so that, not that Nietzsche's correct, or that Marx is correct, or that anyone's correct, but that... that it's all been tried out. That style or form of philosophical thinking has been tried out. In the back of my mind, the rightly so has come from people like Dave Chalmers, who actually do that. He now he now produces almost like a spreadsheet. He doesn't, but something like a spreadsheet that says, here are all the positions that you could possibly take in a metaphysical understanding of how things are here. And it's like a taxonomy, and there's nothing left to think. Right? All you do is you say, all right, I'll pick that one, I'll become one of them. And I'll devise clever arguments to support it.
He did have that on a slide.
Well, yes, yeah, I think he did, yes.
Well, he did, I think, in Australia, John.
Yes.
So
when he spoke at UQ, I recall being there and he had a slide that was something like about that.
Yes.
They're all willing gone.
Yes. So, like the philosophy of mind now is resurrecting panpsychism, you know, which was Spinoza's.
Is it gone?
Yes. So Spinoza is coming back, but it's a bit. You know when you've basically got your box of possible philosophical positions, and it's not philosophy isn't finished. It's more like materialism is in the wane, and a property dualism had a bit of a day, but now it looks like panpsychism is on the up. So different positions move according to the. It's almost like political parties. Only it moves more slowly. There aren't elections. It's the gist of it is that for positions to change, people have to die. And then there's a sort of a position that's more in keeping with the times, if you like. And panpsychism looks like it's going to be more in keeping with the times. But what Heidegger's saying here is, it's all been done, right? It's all been done, and nobody is paying much attention to it either. Yes, there was a time, probably the last time here was with the philosophy of language in Oxford, where what the philosophers were thinking still mattered to a certain intellectual culture, whereas now. What the philosophers think largely only matters to the other philosophers. It doesn't have a large effect on our culture. Our culture is, and this is according to Heidegger, more or less determined by our technologies and by our science. Science and technology now have taken the place, if you like, of what once people looked for in philosophy. And there was a sense, I think, you know, especially with Hegel, there was a sense that Western philosophy was going to come to some kind of fruition, and that the inconsistencies and the incoherences in the scientific worldview were going to be sorted out, and we'd have a kind of a unified philosophical position that you could say would make our culture coherent. Whereas we don't have that. We have a kind of incoherent materialism, and we just live with it. We in some sense, as a culture, we've been that way for so long that people don't even notice it. Do you know how you just become adjusted to a state of disorder? We're disordered as a culture at a very deep level. We don't really know what we're doing or why we're doing it, but we've got very detailed knowledge of certain aspects of the universe through our science, and those sciences are progressing. So we have a kind of a sense that, although we don't know the answers, you know, I feel like a little thing where a little robot saying, although we don't know the answers to the big questions, and maybe we never will, we are making progress. You know, which is in a way of saying a kind of accepting. A state of incoherence, cultural incoherence, and making it sound like it's okay, or as if it would just be too difficult to actually endeavour to live coherently. Anyway, yes, and he's talking here about the development of the sciences. Particularly out of the work of Aristotle, and then their separation and specialization. particularly after the scientific and industrial revolutions, you start getting large communities of people specialising in their particular scientific domains, and that becoming no longer associated with philosophy, and there being no unified kind of philosophical underpinning that connects us all the sciences together, which people like Galileo and Newton still had that sense, and Descartes, that they were working not just on science but on a coherent philosophical, metaphysical foundation for science. And Husserl as well was attempting that in the 20th century, to try and do that again, still working on that kind of dream that we can make coherent sense out of all of our sciences, including psychology, and which would be the science of consciousness, which we're still lacking. And in a way, my going into Metzinger was to demonstrate to you that it's not coherent. But it's all, you see, the people in cognitive science have a kind of an understanding, and they're going forward with it. They're more philosophically aware than many other sciences, because people do recognise that how we understand human beingness is important. But in order to make our culture coherent, it's not a matter of a few people in cognitive science coming up with a good understanding of consciousness. It's somehow got to get into the entire culture. So you haven't read the question concerning technology, which is if you're going to read anything else from Heidegger to kind of back up what he's saying here, you should read that, because he, in his later philosophy, he started to look at technology, and he was the first major philosopher to even notice that technology might be significant in shaping our understanding of being. That our mode of interaction in the world is become completely mediated through technology, and not in a neutral way, meaning that we understand being technologically, or at least we do in certain aspects of our lives. Habermas was another German philosopher more recently. I think he's still alive. He made a distinction, saying that it's like our public life is dominated by this scientific technological view of things, and we still have our private life, which is not dominated in that way. Our life with our near and dear ones, really. But as soon as we get out into work and society, we move into a public world that is basically a technologically dominated world.
The public sphere, you mean?
The public sphere, yes. But he Habermas, I'm not a student of Habermas, but I remember a lecture where somebody was talking about this distinction. I thought, I really feel that. I really feel how... I think it was him that talked about the third space as well, like this, like how important it is to create you've got your family space, you've got your public space of where you're at work, but what about the third space, where you open up a different space that isn't the technologically mediated public world and isn't the family world? You know, it's a world where we can explore a different way of being, a different way of seeing things.
Well, he was very interested in how people found public spaces to debate really important issues. And in the past, he said that this but it's very male dominated. This would happen in things like, you know, sort of coffee houses.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, halls.
That's right.
Halls,
that's right.
Like that. And that these were important. That this was the public sphere in which you could debate important issues. But that, you know, because now the public sphere is very much, you know, technology, radio, television, social media, and all the rest of it, that somehow the impact of the individual voice has become dissipated in the public sphere.
Yes.
Maybe this is why the third sphere, where you're still having this kind of debate, is important.
Yes. Yes, it's very... of course, he didn't know anything about social media.
Yeah.
And that's...
People know that disregarding this individual subjective experiences of people, if you ask somebody like a question about anything, I just Google it, and they get exposed to the same material that's on the internet when you first scratch the surface of any subject. So you can get like a kind of general... a lot of people, whether you're in Japan or in the United States or in China, in a little village in China, you're going to get exposed to the exactly the same.
Yes.
So there's no kind of, what's the point of the subjective kind of individual opinion or take on something?
Yeah, I mean, you're making me, I think there's a, in terms of current research, there's the phenomenology of Google and of social media. I'm sure there must be people looking into this, because it's in terms of the technological mediation of human discourse, this is its new form.
Mm. Yes, it's about, I mean, now it's about, it's not about persuading other people as yourself face to face, it's about creating a profile, a public persona, which then has to attract interaction in the virtual world.
Yes.
You know, so it's a very different strategy for having some
look at the word strategy.
Yeah.
Do you know, would you have a strategy with someone you love? Well
Machiavelli was all yes, about strategy. Yeah, yeah. It's not a new thing.
No, it's not a new thing, but you know, that's not how you negotiate your intimate relationships, is it?
No. But...
And so you stop having intimate relationships while thinking that in fact you do, but the technology is now is starting to eat into that space which previously wasn't dominated in that way, and it's interesting, the whole concern about Facebook and what it's doing with your information and how it's profiting out of it. It's you see the technology has got into its tendrils. And I mean, I don't want to go on because I can make myself feel a bit depressed. Well, because it's the online dating now, isn't it? You're just selecting a. I mean, I can see it.
How people do it.
But it's not. It's. I mean, I'm getting
it's
the same. It's not just. It's not a little. It's not an odd thing. Oh, you do online dating. It's becoming the norm, isn't it?
Yeah.
And
people look you up instead of speaking to you.
And you are a product.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I mean, I'm looking for a car at the moment. It's just like buying a car, and I can see what it's going to do. Right, you know, you've been together 6 weeks. I think I'll just check the, you know, is there a nicer model out there? But I mean, I'm talking as a man. This is how you think anyway, right? When you're the objectifying male brain, it's just bull. But unless you know, she looks nice. Yeah, I think I won't mention anything. You know, to girlfriend number seven. You know, do you see? It's, I mean, it's just products. Yeah, I just have one for. I mean, how long do you want? How long do you keep your car? A couple of years.
I can assure you that promiscuity existed long before the
advent
of social media.
Yes, yeah, yeah. But
especially
no,
in the '60s, as well, you know.
But the sense of that's right, because that capacity to treat other human beings as products or objects or things has been, you know, it's not a new thing, but it's becoming endemic now. It wasn't as if that personal realm of intimacy was we were all living in that heaven. A lot of people maybe didn't find it at all, but it's that it's being invaded. It's being more and more invaded.
Well, I think the thing is, if you're meeting people in bars or nightclubs or whatever, I mean, you are getting to see what's on offer. Whereas on the internet, I mean, people use photographs of other people. They really are not who they say they are a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Whereas at least if you're meeting someone in a club or something, you can have a look at the goods. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, you still actually have to.
No, you're 80 and
physically make
very
love,
dribbly.
Don't you? You still have to physically make love, but we're going to fix that soon,
aren't
we?
Oh yeah, not anymore.
Yeah.
Does this regard to that things are also processes? That the process of getting hooked with somebody is what determines the kind of ideas of them and
there is
quality of relationship.
People are stopping having sex. There is evidence
of
decreasing.
I'm seeing couples now, and their interaction is, you know, they're both looking at the same phone. We're so close that we look at the same phone. You know, I think I'll have to find that. So, having said that, technological humanity, okay, I'm just updating you a bit about. So, technology is neutral, is it? Just look at the internet. Once you introduce the technology, it changes people's behaviour, and people, you don't get a choice. Even if you resist it, you can't function in this world without a smartphone now, right? You can't park. The places you can't park. I mean, you can function, but you have to. The domain of what you can do shrinks. Yet the technology becomes mandatory. You can't really function without the internet now, or if you do, you have to phone you have to phone a relation up and say, "Oh, could you do this for me?" On the there's no way it's a voluntary thing. You are drawn into the technology, and then the technology determines how you interact with other people, and determines how you live your life.
Would Heidegger have read Marshall McLuhan?
The
medium is the message.
He could have done, but I would have. I get the sense that the later Heidegger was just he was in a sort of a rarefied place, only really interested in extracts of Parmenides.
No,
you know,
he was
communing with the ancient Greeks. You know, it was interesting. He mentioned cybernetics here, but I caught a talk that he was having with Eugen Fink, and basically he was having to ask Eugen Fink what is cybernetics. You know, I think he only had a vague idea about the details of what was going on. A bit like me, you know, I can feel as I get older that I'm more and more just got a kind of I know the names of things, but I still have never really engaged in social media. I don't know what it's like to be hooked into it. Do you know, I don't have that immediate experience. So philosophy is ending in the present age. It has found its place in the scientific attitude of socially active humanity. But the fundamental characteristic of this scientific attitude is its cybernetic, that is, technological character. It's interesting he uses the word cybernetics because it dates him. You know, cybernetics was in 1964 was about to be, was being replaced by artificial intelligence. So in 1958 there was the first artificial intelligence conference, and they set out the people in AI to replace the cybernetics movement with a much more the cyberneticians were a much more interesting bunch. They were part of what's now called systems thinking, and they were looking for commonalities in systems across all the domains of life, and not just in computing. Although a lot of the cybernetics work came out of the Second World War and developing machinery that is self-guiding, like one of the famous ones associated with cybernetics was anti-aircraft guns that were able to follow the aircraft and fire automatically. It was the beginning of what we would call computer-controlled weaponry. Self-guiding torpedoes that could guide themselves towards like cruise missiles, etc., etc. That was the cybernetics technologically was applied to in that way. But the principles that were found about how feedback works, feedback control works, people in cybernetics immediately saw, oh, that applies to the nervous systems of animals and human beings. So there was an immediate sense that you could understand human beings and then human social systems and businesses. Stafford Beer is famous for developing cybernetic ideas in how to control and regulate businesses. So partly cybernetics is the study of how to regulate complex systems.
Suicide drones. Can you attack the time?
Yes. Yeah, well, that's the end of something that was started really in the Second World War. As soon as the technology is available, we're going to use it.
Now Israel.
If we don't use it, somebody, the bad guys will use it. But we're the good guys. Yeah, but we've got to use it because the bad guys will use it if we don't use it. And somehow we become the bad guys. How does that work? Anyway.
And they're testing these weapons in a real war. They pick up these places of conflict so to test these weapons.
Yeah.
And they sell that these people are in a conflict. So they go, hey, how about if you buy this?
Yeah, you wouldn't mind answering this questionnaire. Yeah, we've got a questionnaire here. How did it go? How was your experience of our suicide drone?
Yeah. What? How are you going to test them in the real world? You can't test them, so you go to places of conflict and you offer it to them and then you see how it's... and that kind of improves the...
Yeah. I have to say I was working in that world and I was... The word defence contracts came across the desk, but I resolutely refused. I was proud to say in my work, the main thing is that nothing that I ever work on ever comes to have any practical use.
That's kind of relieving.
Yeah, that, as long as that was the case, I was quite happy, you know. Because if you work in that area, right, the practical use of any kind of artificial intelligence is either going to be for war or to take some poor beggar's job away.
Is it called deep learning now?
Well, there is. That's what neural network have become. They've migrated into deep learning. So the whole area is bigger than that. But deep learning is just they had neural networks that for many, many years. But they couldn't get them to do very well at recognizing pictures, for instance. And they've made a few technological advances, and they call it deep learning. But it's just a kind of a narrow aspect of a bigger area.
One question: cybernetic, Aristotle, I think, was speaking of cybernetic, no?
Aristotle. Well, it was a Greek word, so it refers to being a pilot, piloting a ship. But I don't think it was anything like it was. There wasn't cybernetics was a term coined by Norbert Wiener at that time, but he borrowed the Greek term. But there wasn't anything like cybernetics until then, I don't think. And it's only interesting in that Heidegger latched onto it, and for a long time you'd have said, "Oh, he didn't see what was coming," because artificial intelligence came along and replaced cybernetics, which was very interested in learning from nature, systems thinking, how feedback works in all of these different systems, and trying to learn these deep principles that are operative across all different scales. And artificial intelligence came along and said, no, we can do it all with symbolic logic. It was a very mathematical to begin with. It eventuated in expert systems and an idea that you could do everything by using formal logic. And that form of AI has sort of failed. There's deep learning, neural nets, etc. But there is a resurgence now of cybernetic and systems thinking. So in a way, he was on the money. But it's just taken, 50 years for cybernetics to come around. It's not called cybernetics anymore because it got a bad name, funding-wise. You know, you wanted money, you said, what do you do? I'm a cybernetician. Oh, next, so that's how you get rid of a word now. It's it's all to do with funding. What do you do? I'm in AI. Oh, come in. Basically doing very similar work. But the people who stuck with it were kind of visionaries for now. You know, we were looking at autopoiesis and Varela and Maturana. They're now... Maturana's still alive but very old, Varela's died, but they're kind of now recognised as kind of founding people behind the whole complex systems understanding of life that is starting to take hold again. So Heidegger was quite prescient in picking on cybernetics, and I think quite prescient in seeing that he's really talking about artificial intelligence and about what you were talking about earlier, the singularity, the fact that we're going to invest everything in these computer systems that we're going to use to regulate ourselves. And it's the kind of apotheosis of a scientific technological thinking that we're going to ultimately... run the entire show using computer algorithms, which is what's happening. So he picked the word of the day, but what he's pointing to is this increasing computerization, which means systematization, which means formalization of all aspects of life, so that more and more and more, the way the world works is determined by abstract systems. I mean, the most simple one is the idea of the budget. If you've worked in any kind of organisation, you work to the budget. The budget is the kind of the face you can see of the system behind it that's running the whole show. That's basically saying, okay, this is your target. If you reach your target, we leave you alone. If you don't reach your target, then we've got a control system here that's going to come along and punish you. The control system will either get rid of you, or you won't get your bonus. But there are entire sets of formalized systems that really represent a system of rules, regulations, and policies that kind of formalise how we all behave. And more and more and more, our behaviour in business and government is becoming fitted into abstract systems of control.
But not in the free university.
Although, there'll be attempts then, especially when we start having a fight about the rooms. what's the first thing you do? Well, we need a system, and you do, right? But the sense, especially in my work, as soon as you can be measured and recorded into a database, then you're going to be controlled. And I watched it happen in academia. the freedom, you know, what was the word? You got tenure. That's right. Basically, you got tenure. That means you may come in, you may not. You'll probably teach your lectures. You know, you might mark the assignments on time. Somebody comes to your office and says, "So, excuse me, I need some help." You say, "Go away." You know, that was how academia. Not, of course, not everyone was like that, but because nobody could really measure what you were doing. As soon as you start measuring what you're doing, how many hours you're in your office, how many hours you're teaching, how many things did you publish last year, then your targets are set. Dun, 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 dun. You want to be promoted. Well, basically you've got a score here, you know.
That was one of the things we learned about, you know, that the self-perpetuation of bureaucracies, one of the strategies of bureaucracies for self-perpetuation is quantophrenia. Quantophrenia means the sort of mad attempt to quantify everything, even the unquantifiable.
Yes.
So quality of education... quality of educational experience is not necessarily something that's quantifiable.
No.
But by reducing it to, I don't know, number of passes or... I mean, how would you quantify our educational experience in this classroom?
And well, we all recognise that. And then, but our entire educational system is quantified.
Yeah, absolutely. But more and more.
Yes. Even though more and more we may say... it's not working, you can't quantify it. The response is, oh, can't we? Let's see if we can quantify that. What bit do you think we can't quantify? I think we can. You know, we're going to measure... there'll be some output about what you're talking about. And if we measure the output, then we'll reward you for the output. Yeah, and of course, what happens is everybody who's rewarded for the output just goes for the output and forgets the quality.
Absolutely. Yeah, performance.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to start with that, especially those of us who've had experience of it, because we won't want to stop going on about it. But we're just talking about technological humanity. It once was factories, right? But it's creeping in now to every aspect of the way that we work. So Heidegger's being more abstract now. He's talking about what the sciences are based on, because we've been talking about that as well. All of the sciences have their roots back in philosophy, because they have a certain understanding of being, of the region of being in which they are working. And the thing that we've really concentrated on is physics. Right? Physics is a region of being that is, until recently, the entire realm of what is subjective was eliminated from it. It's the realm of the measurable. But you see, that it's philosophy that has taken the whole and said, all right, we're dividing up for physics, you're taking this portion of the whole, the physical. That's why we call you physics. And for psychology, to begin with, we said, okay, if you take the physical, what's left over? It's the psychic. Yes, psychology, psyche. Your job is to study... what physics doesn't study, the psyche. But it was philosophy that made the chop. Yes? And defined this is your region of being. And then the sciences then tend to run with that until they end up in deep trouble. So physics is starting to end up in some kind of trouble. Because that simplistic physical idea of there being bits of stuff doesn't seem to pan out at the quantum physical level. And not just that, you've got this worrying thing where there seems to be instantaneous communication between disparate events that seems to shatter the idea of physical spatiotemporality. You know that, you know, are you familiar with this? If an electron spins out of a certain, if you smash an atom and two electrons are shot out of smashing the atom, they'll be paired or entangled in such a way that if one's spinning in one direction, they don't, I mean, spins just, I'm just using my finger, the other will be spinning in the opposite direction. And they have proven, it's Bell's theorem, I think it's called, or not proven, but there is strong evidence to suggest that the spin of the electron is not determined until it's measured. Yes? Now, don't ask me exactly what that means. It's because the electron, in a way, will only appear when it's measured. As an electron. Before that, it's in a quantum physical superposed state where it could be in many different states at once. When it's measured, it has to kind of show itself in a particular state. Mm-hmm. And they've shown that the entangled particle, if you measure this electron and it's spinning left, the entangled particle will start spinning right, will be determined as spinning right instantaneously. There's no possibility that something from this electron is able to send a signal at the speed of light to the other one and say, oh, I've been caught spinning left, you're right. The way that it works is measured spinning left instantaneously, even if you're the other side of Jupiter, you're now spinning right. And there's strong evidence to suggest this is actually how it works. It was Einstein who said this was a consequence of quantum mechanics, that such a thing would happen. And he took that to be proof that it has to be false, because, as Einstein said, nothing in the universe can travel faster than the speed of light. But there is evidence now that entangled particles remain in contact with each other and in somehow inform each other, regardless of how far apart they are. They remain instantaneously in a state of communication, which undermines the entire notion of physical space and time that we were working under, even post-Newtonian physics.
But there's also evidence of entanglement in biological things, because they found that in a plant, when one array of green things start to photosynthesize, even the things that are not in direct sunlight will also photosynthesize at the same time, because they're all part of the same thing.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm not explaining that very well, but they were. I saw this thing where they were saying that entanglement seems to happen in living things as well.
Yes. Yes, I know that that doesn't necessarily involve faster than the speed of light communication. But I was watching a program too where they were basically saying that photosynthesis itself can't happen without quantum effects.
Right, okay.
And because a lot of people are saying, oh, quantum mechanics, yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of weird thing happening down there, but it doesn't affect the macro level, the behaviour of the atoms and the molecules. But they're discovering things like photosynthesis relies on quantum effects, and also bird navigation. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, I think. That if we discover, which I think is quite likely, that there are quantum effects in the behaviour of neurons, then the old singularity worry starts to disappear. It does, because an ordinary digital computer isn't going to be able to get that kind of leverage. Yes. Yeah. So, we're digressing a little bit again. So, we were talking about the categories that sciences have inherited philosophy, but they've become working hypotheses. That's why I've blued that out. In other words, if things start going wrong in a science, then the scientists working in the area start to ask more searching questions about the assumptions that they're working under, like people in cognitive science are now doing about consciousness. But they don't. There's no longer any unifying philosophy that guides them. They basically, and the physicists are doing this too, they basically start rummaging around for an alternative ontology, an alternative understanding of their realm of being that will fit the results of the experiments that seem to be contradicting things. Yes? So they rummage around, asking a few questions, saying, what's going on here? Can we work out a better framework, a better set of categories in which we can work? Like cognitive science is now toying with panpsychism and quantum mechanics has sort of thrown away the notion of spatiotemporality that it was once working under and the notion of physicality that it was once working under, but only insofar as you run into trouble. If you run into trouble, you go through a bit of a crisis and you come up with a better framework under which to work. And when you've got a new framework, you start asking different questions as well. So that it's not a matter of indifference. The kind of framework that you have determines the kind of questions that you have. Thomas Kuhn is famous for this, for studying the progress of science and the fact that the science goes through paradigm shifts. But that's the way science progresses now. Individual sciences have paradigm shifts. There's no unifying philosophy under which the umbrella, all of the sciences are in some sense coordinated. So you have the absurdity in a way for a long time that the physicists have thrown out the standard ontology of materialism in the 1920s. And yet the biologists of this century, many of them are still rigidly materialistic. But the irony being, they're rigidly materialistic in the sense that they say it can all be reduced to physics. And so you go to the physicists and you find the physicists have got some crazy ideas. You know, they mean reduced to the physics of the last century. Do you know? Because the sciences are not coordinated in that way. And the people don't have time to really become current with what is happening in the other sciences. They all form their own sphere of interest, they don't really care that much, because the aim of the science is to, in some sense, to progress, to get ever more effective technological outcomes from what is being done.
Like a continuous state of revolution.
Yes.
And people don't like that.
No, but science is, people who are attracted to science are usually driven by some, many are, not all, I mean, many are driven by the glory, the fame, but behind that, unless you're interested in the work you're doing for itself, for the discovery. And many, many people have this, to discover something, it's extraordinary, even if it's just a new computer algorithm. To get into a realm almost of the human psyche where no one has been before, it's like the same as drove people to climb Everest. You know, there's still, in the intellect, there's still places like that where you're the first consciousness to arrive at this place. And there's a great reward in that. And you'll find many scientists, they really are inspired by what they're studying, particularly those that study nature, because they do find extraordinary order. They glimpse extraordinary order in what they're theorising about. They're not just making it up, unless they're doing string theory. Sorry, anybody who's doing string theory. But they find extraordinary order there, actually, in the mathematics. So they too get a kind of a... So yes, he's saying theory now means the supposition of the categories. You find a framework that's productive for your research, which means it only has a cybernetic or a function. It's what works. You pick the understanding that works. You're not concerned with the ontological meaning anymore. And Heidegger describes this as representational calculative thinking. It's later on he describes it as frenzied rationality. And he's basically saying this is how we are now. This is how we operate. So it's the fourth point there, because we've been discussing this about the regional. The end of philosophy proves to be the triumph of the manipulable arrangement of a scientific technological world and of the social order proper to this world. The end of philosophy means the beginning of the world civilization that is based upon Western European thinking. I mean, I feel he's nearly a prophet, isn't he? Because we're much further down. He's prophesying that in the early 1960s. He would regard Russia as a kind of Soviet Russia as a kind of expression of Western European thinking, but even more so now with the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's not as if it's as if the character of the world civilization that we exemplify now is unleashed. There's no kind of Soviet bloc that it has to react to anymore. So it's colonization of the planet is now unchecked.
Does he mean by Western European thinking? I thought that there were two basic divisions, wasn't there? There was the sort of American-British sort of philosophical tradition and the sort of continental.
Yes, he means us. He means the Anglos, primarily.
Oh, okay, right.
And the predomination of that form of thinking is the predomination of
Anglo-American
technologization of the world. That it, in a way, you know, I think Heidegger would say that German culture was holding out against that, and that's partly why that against the. The technopoly, as it's properly being called by Neil Postman, against the utter surrender of human culture to science and technology, which he regards as an essentially American thing, but you know originated largely with the British, with us, I think he thought in the early days of Hitler was going to be some kind of alternative to that, some kind of alternative development of European culture that was going to somehow avoid what has happened, which he regards as a kind of catastrophe. Now, that's not to say he thought that Nazism was the answer, but he thought that there was going to be a different kind of revolution in Germany, and he thought he was going to be, in some sense, the philosopher king.
Aww.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. He had a dream. He did have a dream. But it didn't work out, did it?
Do you think his...
Martin.
Do you think his feeling there is that he's a bit of a Cassandra? There he is going, whoa, whoa, and thrice woe, and no one's heeding his call. Or do you think he still thought that he had the ability to change everything?
No, I think it's coming later. he's got a sense that it's sort of hopeless at the moment, but he, in some sense, he's got a now. He feels it's hopeless now. The way he's writing that he's laying the ground for something that may come to fruition in the future. Mm. That in fact this era, if you like, of the complete domination of the earth by Western European technological scientific culture is upon us, and there's no signs of it abating or changing. It's just going to become more and more itself. But there's going to be a turn eventually. And it doesn't take a genius to see that it's an unsustainable culture. So there is going to be a turn. Heidegger, if you like, is saying, I think quite knowingly, I'm going to die before there's any kind of turn, but I'm leaving this for you. For anyone who can hear me. And the end of philosophy, most eloquently, he reminds me of Stephen Hawking, when he was still with us, talking of just this, that philosophy is defunct. Nobody at Cambridge, none of the leading physicists are paying any attention to any philosophers. We're telling you about the ontology of the universe. It's physics that is doing the philosophy now. And similarly, the people who are studying consciousness, they think they're doing the philosophy now. It's what we discover about how the brain works is going to determine how we understand human being. It's our scientific technological culture that is determining our understanding of who we are and our understanding of what the universe is. Philosophy is, to all intents and purposes, finished. That's not who we go and interview now, saying, please tell me, Hegel, you know. And similarly, I think the era where there's someone like Heidegger or Wittgenstein, where you say, all hail the great philosopher, I think that's gone now. You've just got a bunch of very clever people, but they've become professionals. Philosophy, in fact, has become a separate, like one of the sciences. It's become a sort of a separate discipline amongst other disciplines. And it's starting to, funding-wise, it's got no practical economic outcomes. It's not good. What kind of job are you going to get? It won't die out if there's a sudden resurgence of some kind of genuine cultural change. I think people might come back and demand that they're taught something like philosophy, but as it stands within the structure of the modern university, all the philosophy departments are they're going.
When they used to teach something called critical thinking, which is just basically looking at arguments. The government acts that as a subject at A level and stuff. So no more. I used to teach critical thinking as part of access to university courses. No more.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you think, well.
But I remember, because I was wandering around the halls of the philosophy departments. That's basically what they say. You know, oh, you need us because we can teach everyone to think critically, to evaluate arguments. It's very useful. It really is. But the defence of philosophy wasn't anything like. You know, without philosophy, the culture has no head. That's what we should be saying. No head. You just cut the head off. that would be the what.
Artists as well. They create machines that don't have any purpose. They just do stuff without any purpose. Maybe it's going to go to that direction. The drive towards a purpose is going to die out.
I mean, the purpose. It's all become localised within the sciences. The purpose of each science is to progress, is to develop better theories and better technology. So in a sense that each science has its purpose, and then the economy has the purpose. The economy has the purpose to drive the sciences to get the better technology so we remain competitive. You know, the whole engine is all all connected together. And within that, you know, at the Department of Industry, we're saying, well, how many philosophers do we need? What effect is that going to have on GDP?
But they don't actually, even at the level of critical thinking, I think a lot of people don't want that. They don't want people to be critical.
Well, there's a certain... I mean, I accept the argument there that there's a definite need, if you're living in a culture of continual innovation, that you have people who don't just learn by rote. You know, have to have an ability to stand above things, if you like, and abstract themselves and see the bigger picture and see what's possible. And all of that, philosophy does have a role to play, but philosophy isn't, you know, this is the tragedy of it, it's not training people to think critically. You know, that's just education, isn't it? That just should just be what is education.
It's not even that now.
I know, it's good. Everything's becoming... I mean, it's partly, if you do study anything now, the sciences are so specialised that doing a degree in a science is like having done an O-level once. You know, you've got to do a PhD before you get to the edge of being able to do any useful work. You know, there isn't time for a superfluous subjects. You know, if you want to do anything in a particular area of science, you've got to specialise early and do nothing else, because life is short. Till we develop the computers that will do all that work for us.
Well, in some, for example, in medicine, if I'm not wrong, they studied some philosophy, epistemology, and they need to study. It's like a subject in the curriculum.
Yes.
Because it's mandatory to analyze all the context of the epistemology in medicine. And I think in some ways in another subjects also.
Yes, there'll be room for philosophy within an individual subject. Mm-hmm. Yes. Like in biology, we're studying what the question of what is life. Mm-hmm. There'll be but in effect, the work that's happening there is not metaphysics. It's a kind of a self-criticism of the foundations of what you're doing. Or if it might not even be a self-criticism, it might just be an explanation of the foundations of what you're doing. But that's, in a way, what Heidegger was saying earlier, that the individual sciences do reflect on their regional categories, especially when they're in a crisis. And like medicine is coming into a crisis now because of its being so mechanistic. It's ignored the subjectivity. It hasn't really had a concept of what it means to be healthy. Mm. It's regarded everybody as a machine that's defective and needs to be fixed. So it's got epistemological problems, which will cause the you know, training of doctors is starting to try and move with the times. But do you see, there's no need for there's no overarching, you know, I know what I'm saying. There's no overarching philosophical understanding that unifies all the sciences, that is the queen of the sciences. That once was, I mean, for us, it was the Christian Church. It was the overarching authority. We've made a virtue of having no such authority, and we're back to last week. You know, no one's responsible. So, and this is the second part of the lecture. So, I think I'm going to save this. So, Heidegger's in a way is the first part of the lecture is saying, do you see, philosophy's finished. It's actually finished. Nobody's listening to the philosophers anymore. The middle of the last century was the last time. You know, people actually read Being and Time. You know, the German public, the educated German public. It was hot off the press. And you've read it, right? It's not going to be a bestseller now, is it? I mean, Just give it to me. I've got 5 minutes. What? It's all right. Google, being in time. Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. I'll just read the first paragraph. I got it, yeah, roughly. Next. You know. So Heidegger's about to say, right back at the very beginning, of what has been philosophy for the West, did we miss something? And that's what I think I'd like to make that next week's. Okay, good night everyone on the recording.